Blog Talk Radio.
Best-selling author Steve Martini. Make sure you stick around for that one. For the past 20 years, Steve has been one of North America's best-selling, the most critically acclaimed author of legal thrillers. So he's going to be able to kind of get a little insight into what he does with his storytelling, how he crafts stories, uses his experience, uses his profession to bring you those fantastic legal thrillers. And they're also going to dip into his imagination, into the darkness of how to write a gripping villain. So it should be a very entertaining interview. I've heard it, and it is very exciting. We also want to let you know that, of course, our show is brought to you by KensingtonBooks.com. Make sure you check that out for all the latest news and information they have on their authors. Also, Dark Renaissance Books is another one to go to. Go to DarkRenaissanceBooks.com for more information on what they have going on, some really cool thriller horror stuff that they've been putting out. And, of course, Kevin Hurley with his newest book, Cut and Cover, has been released. Make sure you go check out silkreel.com for more information on what Kevin's got going on. This is the time of giving. This is Christmas time. And we also want to let you know that this is also the time when, you know, we have to mourn again 14 people that have died and their families in San Bernardino, California. We, of course, are here in Los Angeles. It's very close to us in Southern California. And we just want to say that our thoughts are going out, of course, with their family and all the families of the victims that happened with that tragic, horrific event on Wednesday. So, again, we want to say that it's got to stop. You know, let's leave the crime in the books. And this has just got to stop. 355 mass shootings over 340 days is too much for anyone to stomach. So, again, let's leave the crime and the thrillers and the serial killers and all that stuff in the pages of the books that we read. So now, without any further ado, let's hit it right now with the Story Blender. Of course, here's Stephen James and Susan May Warren with Steve Martini. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Susan May Warren.
And I'm Stephen James.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. So I can't wait for our guest today, Stephen. He is so awesome, and I'm a huge, huge fan. And so why don't you tell everybody who is on the line today with us?
Well, yeah, it's exciting. Steve Martini was born in San Francisco. He grew up in the Bay Area in Southern California, and as an honors graduate of University of California at Santa Cruz, his first career was in journalism. Well, after working as a newspaper reporter in Los Angeles and as a correspondent, he began to specialize in legal issues, then got his law degree, pursued a law career, and eventually turned to writing. In 1984, he began to focus on fiction, and 8 years later, Compelling Evidence, the novel that introduced attorney Paul Modigliani, was published and became a national bestseller. Since then, Steve has had both a critical and popular following in his many best-selling novels. And Steve, thanks for being here today.
Well, I appreciate your having me.
Yeah, we met briefly at one of the Thriller Fest conferences, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, and I was just impressed by your just kind of humble demeanor, and it was nice. I know. What do you say to somebody who says that to you?
No, we put our pants on the same way everybody else does, and
yeah.
You try not to get too wrapped up in the in the hype and the hoopla of any kind of profession. But and there's a lot of marketing that goes on around the books and everything. So you sort of,
yeah,
after a few years, you sort of take it as a grain of salt, you know.
Yeah. Right. So we were talking before we got on the air. Susie, you actually first got introduced to Steve a completely different way.
Yeah, I lived overseas, and when you're living overseas, people just generously send you things. And I got a whole box of Steve Martini books, and I was like, what's this? And I dove in, and I was an instant fan. I love his character, Paul, and I just loved everything he wrote. And so I've been a huge fan for years. Love the courtroom stuff, the lawyer stuff. It's, you know, Steve, you're a little grittier than John Grisham, which I really like. And, your character, Paul, has a lot of flaws and that sort of thing, which is really interesting as he goes forward. And we've interviewed a lot of other lawyers who become best-selling authors, but where do you think that bent for writing comes from in so many lawyers? It's just, you know, is it seeing so much drama in real life that they want to explore it in fiction? Or, you know, what propelled you to go into fiction writing?
It wasn't my legal career that caused that. It was probably my journalism background that I found something therapeutic about beating on a keyboard. And early on in my career, I used an old typewriter, an old Royal typewriter, and you really had to pound on those things. So there was something about making words and getting them on paper and polishing your thoughts, and that I found, is the craft that is a certain kind of therapy, I think, for some people. And the ability to, in the fiction field, to rewrite and hone your material, which you don't have that luxury often when you're writing hard news because you're on such a rapid deadline, that I found even more so in terms of therapy. So it was, it came from journalism more than it did from the law, although I did a lot of writing in my legal career as well, because I did a lot of briefing for other lawyers who didn't like to write. There's a lot of trial lawyers who don't particularly like to do the writing.
That's interesting.
Steve, you just mentioned something I found, kind of intriguing, and that is in journalism, you have these tight deadlines. It's due at midnight or whatever, and you just don't have time to hone things like you want. When you work on your novels, do you tend to go through numerous drafts and continually do that, or kind of how's your process? I know every writer is a little bit different. I tend to do that a lot, print it out, maybe make changes, re-edit them over and over. Some people don't do that.
I tend to edit as I go. I don't generally do a completed version of the manuscript and then go back through it and rewrite it in that fashion until the editor has had an opportunity to do a cold read on it and give me his line notes. But I usually will rewrite chapters many times in the process of crafting the original manuscript. And sometimes I have to discipline myself not to overwrite. You can do 20 versions of a chapter if you're not careful and realize that your seventh version was the best one you had, and they've all been downhill since then. So you learn as you go on over the course of years, not to spend too much time. Sometimes you're better off going on and moving forward and then going back and looking at something you were troubled by later when you have a little more perspective to look at it.
Now, experience teaches some of that, I know, over the years, as you mentioned. What are other aspects that, especially aspiring writers can say, okay, this, any ways to evaluate, each chapter as they move forward, this is ready, or at this point, it's going to start going downhill. Are there any benchmarks or anything that you can share that if you've thought of over the years?
What I've done over the years is I've generally either read to myself out loud or read to someone else. I'll call someone in and I'll say, can you listen to this for a second and give me your thoughts on it? And it's not so much their thoughts, although occasionally you'll get some good input from someone who's heard it for the first time. It's the reading and the listening with your own ear as to whether or not it works, okay? Often that's very true of dialogue in particular. And if you develop a good ear for critical appraisal of your own work, that's probably the most important thing I think a writer can have. And you can never be too harsh on yourself in that regard, because you have to remember, a lot of people are going to be spending their time and valuable money to buy the book, okay? And you want to make sure that whatever you write has a certain verisimilitude about it, that it's something that the dialogue would stand up, okay, against anything that's out there. It's that kind of appraisal that you want to try and bring to your writing. And I think, I hate to say it, but I think to some extent you either have that ear or you don't. Okay, you can maybe develop it over time. You can certainly sharpen it over time and become more critical. But if you don't have the ability for that kind of self-criticism, it's going to be hard to be a good novelist, I think.
Yeah, I think it is true. And, you know, in some other arenas, we just kind of accept that some people are gifted and others mm-hmm. maybe aren't quite as gifted, say mm-hmm. singing or music perhaps, or playing mm-hmm. a musical instrument and so on, that some people just maybe don't have that acumen. And it is mm-hmm. true, I think, for mm-hmm. for writing as well. We can certainly improve, but mm-hmm. but talent, natural talent, does play a big role, I think.
It does. And the ability to work hard. It is hard work. I don't care what anybody mm-hmm. says.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing,
yeah.
Nothing I've ever found that's more difficult. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's probably some high-tech stuff in the computer field that I've I've given up on that is difficult, but simply because there's so much to know. But
right.
But writing is difficult. It is it's very difficult.
You know, I really agree. For me, writing is a real challenge, and lots of it is because I have to dig deep inside my own experiences and my own fears and struggles and pull them out and put them on the page. And I'm just curious, so what about you? Where do you find, you know, the personal journeys of your characters? Do you go inside? Do you look around? And why do you find it to be a challenge to write?
Well, where do I start? Most of my characters are composites, as I think is true of most fiction writers. They're mm-hmm. Made up of people that you've rubbed shoulders with. None of them are whole individuals that you've known. Very, very, very seldom does that happen. Usually you pick little attributes from this person or that person, a friend, someone that you've had a difficult time with, you know, different relationships, and you mold them into one person and then try and make that person walk on the page. In terms of the dynamic of the storylines and where the stories come from, a lot of mine come from, I'm a news junkie, always have been, so a lot of it comes from what's currently topical in national and international news at any given time. What are the controversies? And you have to be careful of that, because those controversies can outstrip you. They can happen much faster than your book can come out. And you can end up with an old story if you're not careful. So you try not to cut too close to the bone of reality, but you try and pluck out those elements that are almost timeless in a scandal or a controversy, and try and stick with those and make the story float. And sometimes you get very lucky. I just finished a manuscript called Blood Flag, and it'll be out in May, that I was very, very lucky in terms of finding material on, because it was something that no one's ever written on, to my knowledge anyway, and it had some incredible opportunities. Every time I went and did research, I found something new I hadn't expected that provided another twist for the story. So, but that has never happened before. It was the first time in my writing career, 25 years or more at this point, that where that's occurred. But it was it's a blessing. I'd love to see it again, but I doubt that I ever will. Yeah.
No, that brings up actually a really interesting point, and that is, so as you work and as you research, mm-hmm. you do you see the story unfold? You mentioned that some of the twists came up that you maybe hadn't anticipated. People mm-hmm. go through, some people plan out, of course, plot out, outline novels and so on. Others write more organically. How do you find that journey as you research some of these unique ideas? And I love that phrase, by the way, cutting close to the bone of reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant. So how do you see that story shape with the research and the ideas that you pour into it?
Usually I do a lot of research before I start writing, and the writing itself is usually compressed. In fact, I had an exchange of emails with my agent just last week. She was surprised I produced the last book as quickly as I did, and I said, well, you know, none of the books have taken me more than 120 days to write, okay? With the exception of the first two that I wrote, because I was working full-time and writing them on weekends and nights and vacation days.
Right.
But since I've been writing full-time as a novelist, which occurred in the late, early 90s, with the inception of that period of time, most of the books have been written in a fairly compressed time frame. And I do that for a specific reason. It's hard to maintain continuity if you get away from a story for any length of time. If things interrupt your story, you have to go on tour for another book, or you've got a departure, you've got to come back and get your head back into that story. And it requires you basically to pick up the beginning threads of the story and read all the way through to where you left off and hope mm-hmm. you can pick up all the reins and run with them. But my storytelling actually takes place in about 4 months, okay? And if you're on a yearly cycle, the rest of that time is expended in doing research. And I've always enjoyed research. Some people don't. I know I've talked with Grisham, and Grisham says he hates it. He just doesn't want to do it. And, it's just a difference in individuals. I can sometimes get lost in the research and find myself, it's like pouring through pages of an old encyclopedia or surfing the web. You know, you get on there, and before you know it, you're into all kinds of things you hadn't planned on looking at, but they're there and they're interesting, and so you read them. So I am that way a little bit, and I can find myself taking detours and have to bring myself back to the main purpose of why I'm doing the research, and that is to try and get a thread for a story and make it as linear as possible and keep the story going. But the research does feed, two things really feed a good story for me. One is research, and the other is location. If I can travel to an area and actually soak up the ambiance and the color of that area, it propels the story forward. The location can often become part of the story itself.
Yeah, I think, when I teach on writing, I like to think of location as being so central to the story that you can't just pick up the story and dump it into a different city or different state somewhere, that it's so integral to it that it's vital. It's almost like a main character within the story, like location. I like to tell people, treat location like a character and make it that vital to the story.
That's very true. Yeah, very true. Yeah, it's culture and all the other things that go into, especially if it's a foreign location. But even if it's domestic, even if it's just another city in the United States, every city and every town is different. The people there are sometimes different. So, yes.
So I'm curious. So as you do your research, the story starts to come together. But you talked about how you keep it pretty tight. And mm-hmm. so do you tend to then get all the information and then just set out onto the story course, or are you more of an outliner? Do you like to have the story completely put together before you jump in?
I outline. And,
oh, do you? Okay.
I'm an outliner. Yeah, I am. Sometimes the outlines are more detailed than at other times. Some of them have been very detailed. Some of them are just sort of a global overview of where the story's going, okay, in terms of the general plot points. But these kinds of stories, when you're writing international thrillers or courtroom dramas, you better know where you're going, okay? It's not general fiction. You just can't write a story about characters and hope the story works out well in the end. You know, you're likely to find yourself writing up a lot of dead ends and wasting a lot of time. I did that on my first novel, so I know of what I speak here. I didn't have an outline in the first story that I wrote, and I ended up wasting a tremendous amount of time and energy in the process. So,
And that's so interesting because, I don't outline. I'm an organic writer, and I've often told people my books are too complex to outline. And so it's intriguing to hear, you're saying your books are complex and that requires an outline. And I've always thought, exactly the opposite because there's so many twists and turns that I'm like, there's no way I could have ever, figured that out beforehand. And that's an interesting perspective.
You're right. A lot of the twists and turns will evolve during the course of the story. They're not necessarily outlined into my outlines, okay? But I think you need to know where the story is going and what you hope to, where the end is. If you can see the beginning, the middle, and the end, and if you have a sense of your characters, and in a continuing series, you always have, a handle on most of your characters, not all of them, because you don't know who the antagonists are going to be. But I would say like the last book I wrote, there were probably two major twists in the story that were not outlined in, that came as opportunities, okay? And you have to have a keen eye to see where the opportunity arises, and you start thinking, hey, this could be a wicked twist if I take it in that direction.
Yeah,
those
aren't
easily built into an outline. Yeah, those are not built into an outline often.
Nice.
So when you're developing your story, you kind of look at the news and you see what, you know, what is interesting, what topics you could write about. You then go into the research of the place and the culture and the situation. Now you're still writing about Paul, what's his name, Madriani? Is that how
Madriani.
You pronounce
mm-hmm.
it?
Yep.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's your constant character that he's, mm-hmm. you know, going through every story with. So do you look at Paul and go, okay, what does he need to accomplish in this book? How does he need to change? Or do you look at the plot and say, this is the plot, and we're going to put him through the plot, and he's going to, you know, change in this way because of the plot? So do you start with the character first, or do you start with the concept first and then kind of put him through that grid?
The concept, and it's, mm-hmm. it's difficult. Let me tell you why. You have what I've done. My stories have evolved over the years. They started out as strict courtroom dramas, okay? And I went through my early phase as a writer, probably the first 10 or 12 books, okay, were confined to the courtroom, and slowly I got tired of that. I also started seeing reviews come back that were saying too many talking heads, okay? And that's what you're going to have in a courtroom. You know, how often do gunfights erupt in a courtroom? It doesn't happen.
Right.
You don't have, your opportunities for action are somewhat limited, you know? So I slowly started moving my characters out of the courtroom, and that became a challenge because how do you do that? Well, the one way you do it with lawyers is if they conduct their own investigations, and often lawyers will, especially in small firms, they'll get intimately involved. They hire investigators to do parts of it, but they'll do good parts of it themselves as well. They not only evaluate what their investigators bring to them, but sometimes they'll, if it's something important, they'll go back and check it themselves, okay? So there's an opportunity for some action involved in that. And
mm-hmm.
then what you have is you have surprises that occur, okay? Things that erupt during the process of the investigation that then place them in jeopardy. And that's what I've tried to employ as technique, basically, to get my guys out of the courtroom as much as possible. Now, there are still some courtroom scenes, and there's always courtroom motivation behind the story. There's a judge beating on them who wants this by next Tuesday or that by next Thursday. They're up against deadlines here and there. They're facing indictments. Their clients are facing indictments for certain things. So there's always a legal motivation behind their conduct, okay? But it doesn't always take place in the courtroom. So I moved in that direction to take my characters away. And in the last book that was published, they end up in Switzerland, okay, because it involves international banking. And so, you know, I thought, well, that's a good place to go. And so I went there with my daughter, and we did extensive research, took a lot of photographs. These are not photographs that tourists would ordinarily take. These are photographs you'd take with an eye toward developing a story. It might be in a shady alley someplace behind a building, but you want to know where all the doors and windows are and what the color of the alley is, you know, so that when you write about it, you've got something to look at that sort of pins your frame of mind in place. And if someone goes there, you're not going to get a lot of nasty letters and emails saying you got it wrong. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Wow. That's cool. That's mm-hmm. very cool.
Yeah.
So when you like maybe read, say, a novel or watch a movie or film or television show or something like that, what do you think is the kind of at the core of the stories that resonate the most deeply with you? Does it tend to be maybe moral dilemmas of the characters or the unique quirkiness of the characters? What is it that really attracts you to certain stories and makes them memorable or gripping?
Good character-driven stories are just by definition memorable, okay? So if you've got a conflict, either ethical, moral, you know, whatever, involved, and you can see that, you know, you see it in many of the HBO productions that are now cutting edge and in some of the other ongoing series that you see on television. We're really at a sort of high point, I think, in developing some of that. So people always look back at the 50s and they say, you know, the old Playhouse 90 stuff and all this old stuff that, you know, sometimes you can see on Kinescope was the high point of television in terms of drama. I think they're wrong. I think the stuff that's coming out today out of some of these studios is actually quite good, and the writing is superb.
Yeah, I agree.
It's hard to find stuff that's, you know, more propelling and more compelling than that. I think that where you have people who are compromised, who are flawed, who have made bad decisions, and you play that out in a multi-part series, and you see it develop from something that's a minor wrong committed in their youth to the point where they're, you know, commissioning assassinations as adults, you know, you start to see this stuff, and you see it start to play out in ways that has meaning for people in their lives. You know, kids who watch that should take the lesson, you know, take it to heart. But it's quite realistic and very well done. Yeah.
So yeah, I love character-driven stories, too. And you're right, there's some really great stuff on TV nowadays. And, you know, I grew up in the generation of, you know, my mother saying, don't watch TV, and I'm a complete TV addict. So I think that you can get great story from you know, yeah, like you said, HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, and even some of the network shows are really, really good. So
when you get a break from writing now, you can binge on the stuff. You can watch 10 or 15 episodes and see an entire season, you know.
Oh, I know.
Which we couldn't do 10 years ago, you know.
And then you can really see the character development over those. And that's what I really love about even just like Law and Order. You know, you see character development even though it's a police procedural show, you know.
Yes.
So that's fantastic. It is fun to kind of binge watch that. So that brings me to another question. And that is, you know, you're on, what, book 13, I think, with Paul's journey. And how, right? Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds about right. I think I've done...
Yeah.
I think
you don't keep track anymore.
Books in all. Yeah, I've done 17 in all. Yeah.
Oh, 17. Okay.
Well,
all right. Maybe I need to catch up.
No. I've done 17 in all, and I think your count of 13 in the series is probably accurate.
Okay. Good. I just want to make sure I'm up to date.
Yeah.
I don't want to miss a book here. I'm going to have to go back and make sure I get them all. But you know, every story is different, right? And so obviously you go to the news. But I mean, after 13 books of the same character, are you thinking, you know, how do I keep this fresh? How do I keep this interesting? Where do I take him next? I mean, how do you make the next book different, interesting, and you know, what's in your mind as you're crafting? I mean, obviously you can only have so many affairs and murders and you know all these different kinds of, you know, situations that you have. Do you ever find yourself struggling to repeat, you know, not wanting to repeat a plot, but stuff sneaking back in? Or, you know, help us understand how do you keep it fresh?
Basically with subject matter, okay? And that's why I say I like to do research. You want to be careful how detailed your research gets sometimes, but, you know, bomb making, how to make nuclear devices, you know, these are things that have all entered the stories that I've written, okay? And usually by delving into these areas and by breaking away from the first-person voice, my earlier stories were all written in the first-person narrative. So if Paul wasn't on stage and he wasn't in the scene, the reader couldn't see it. Okay, it happened off stage. So I got away from that and I mixed my point of view with omniscient point of view pretty much, as well as the first person. So when Paul's present, you see it through his eyes. When he's not present, you see it through an omniscient point of view. Okay, and by being able to alter that from scene to scene, it opened up a whole new canvas for me to paint on, basically. And I did that about, I don't know how many books back, but it's been quite a few books back I answered that. And by doing that, it gave me a lot of latitude in terms of storytelling that I wasn't able to do before. And so now you can get into some of the subject matter materials. And those subject matter materials not only inform me, they're things I don't know anything about, and so I go and do research or talk to people, experts who know about them, but they also inform the reader, okay? What is an implosion device? You know, how does a nuclear gun type device work as opposed to implosion? You know, what are the differences?
Right.
Okay, why is one easier to make than the other? Okay, I went through all of that stuff on a series of books, one in particular, and because the story was about the attempt to smuggle a nuclear device into the United States and to basically explode it in Southern California, and so it's all of that stuff will drive a story, okay? And it freshens the story, believe me. it keeps your mind tuned as a writer because you're learning something as you go. And hopefully it informs the reader of something they've never read about before. So, and I do a lot of reading in the nonfiction area. I don't read a lot of fiction myself, but I read nonfiction. Biographies, history, The Making of the Atomic Bomb is one of the best books written in modern times, as far as I'm concerned. And it's a fascinating book. It goes back to the 1800s and nuclear fission and comes forward with the science all the way to the point of the Manhattan Project. So it's a fascinating story.
So you kind of look for things that interest you as a person and say, okay, this would probably interest my readers, and then you kind of dive in and follow that course.
And you try
you
try and stay out of the weeds. I mean, obviously,
right.
You've got a book, a history book there that's written probably 700-800 pages, 900 pages in extensive detail with footnotes. Obviously, you don't want to get into that kind of detail, but you want to capture the main high points of it, of part of the story, okay, and make those your major plot points in your in your novel, and give just enough technical detail so that you've dressed it up a bit with authenticity, okay,
yeah.
And facts that if someone checks them out are accurate, and then go from there. Yeah.
That is fantastic. That's great advice. I love it.
Yeah, and I think, didn't you mention earlier, too, I don't even know how to say it right, verisimilitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that authenticity, that believability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the key, you know, is even if something's impossible, as long as it's believable, people accept it.
They will.
And it's like, oh, well, yeah, I guess that's believable. That's believable. And we lead them along that pathway until they come to the place where they're like, no, really, I think that there really is somebody smuggling a bomb in a suitcase, you know, across the border. And
it happens. That's the point. Someone will write a novel about something. I mean, I remember writing books about tunnels being dug under the border in Southern California, you know, and now they're finding all kinds of tunnels dug under there that are being used for smuggling marijuana, smuggling immigrants, okay, across the border. And the fear has always been that if they get adequate funding from, you know, a foreign power, a terrorist group might well smuggle a nuclear device through the same. And that's, I've written books on the subject. So it's interesting stuff. You see how it all ties together. And it's almost frustrating sometimes because before your novel can come out, all of a sudden there'll be a breaking story somewhere on the inside pages of a newspaper. You know, you'll see a wire service story or something that the events that you're talking about in your story have actually occurred, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I actually did this book called Singularity, which is about a drug cartel's quest to get an autonomous or thought-controlled drone from Area 51 and acquire it, basically. And when it came out, it was like, one of the reviewers said, is this true? Like, they actually thought it might have been nonfiction. And then within a few weeks, came out that after the book was released that's actually what drug cartels were trying to pretty much do. And and so you're right when you say we want to be on that cusp, on that edge of trying to think through where could this story be, but we don't want to be behind the curve either.
That's it. Yeah. No, it's a tough one tough act to follow sometimes. But yeah, reality is often stranger than fiction. It is remarkable, and there are times when I wish I'd been a sci-fi writer, but I don't know that I have a science background to do it. But there have been hints of some sci-fi in some of the books that I've written more recently, and where you get into space technology and things like that. But there's so much going on right now in the world, and things are changing so fast in the publishing field as well as other fields. We're seeing little bits of it here. In terms of economics of the book publishing world and all of that, but the world is changing so fast, and it's largely being driven by changes in technology that we can't even imagine what's going to exist in 25 years. We don't have a clue, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I, speaking of change in technology and the world changing a lot, I was curious. I read somewhere that you made the decision to become a writer. After you did that, you didn't get a contract right off the bat that very year. It took, a while. And a lot of successful authors have gone through a lot of years of writing and revising and learning the craft before getting picked up. And then they're not really going to the traditional route. They're going into self-publishing. And that's, you know, I guess it's a lot easier just to press a button on your keyboard and self-publish than to go through 6 or 8 years of rejection. But what do you think about that? Have you thought about self-publishing? I mean, you have a lot of books out there, and you're doing very well. Is this something that you would consider doing? What do you think about people that are doing this? And, just what's your take on that?
I'm pretty long in the tooth at this point to be considering that. I'm you know, closer to the end of my career than I am the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing in the late 80s,
Right.
And I never really had a problem with the publishing industry per se. I mean, they treated me pretty well, I have to say.
Yeah.
And I struggled in terms of long-term projects in my writing, but only because I was working full-time in the day on the
mm-hmm.
first two books. I did a mystery actually before Compelling Evidence. I did a story called The Simeon Chamber, and it was a straight out mystery about 400
yeah.
pages in length. And I sold that to a small publisher in New York, and that's how I launched myself initially as a writer. And it sold very quickly, actually. It sold within a matter of days once I submitted it to the agent. It was the first nibble they got was an offer of a contract, and we took it. But it didn't free me from my day job. It was a small contract for a nominal sum of money. They wanted multiple books, and I was on the hook to do my day job and write these on the side, within a prescribed time frame. And the deadlines were longer. They didn't expect a book a year from you when you're working full time. But in any event, it wasn't until my second book that I actually broke out and hit the list and was able to. So there was about 8 years of struggle in there where I wrote the first book on the side without a contract, sold it, then wrote the second one over a 4-year period and sold it. And then after that, they offered me multi-book contracts, and I was able to quit my day job and write full time. In terms of self-publishing, the advice being given by people who know a lot more than I do about the subject is to try and go the traditional route for aspiring authors. Okay, you want to go the traditional route. Find a traditional publisher who gives you a signing advance and who pays advances and allows you basically to spend your time more profitably writing. Okay, and I think there's good advice in that. These people are experts in marketing, how to brand your book, how to put it in a particular genre so that it sells better, how to create a recognizable name for yourself. Okay, they have a lot of techniques that they've learned over many, many decades. So there is a certain benefit and an advantage in staying with a traditional publishing route. For other people who are having difficulty, there have been people who have had vast success doing that. Self-publishing, going out with the e-books, maybe printing a small number of hardcover books, maybe trying to sell them themselves. But usually when you're forced into that corner is an indication that you've been unable to sell the books to a publisher. And you have to ask yourself the question, why? Okay, why have you failed to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the reason is because editors have looked at that and decided they're not interested. Now, they might not be interested because you're writing in a genre that they don't recognize as being valuable. And they,
right.
And it's happened many, many times. I mean, I don't want to tell you the number of authors I've talked to who are at the top of the New York Times bestsellers list over the years who have been turned down by 12, 13, 14 publishers on a book. And, rejections, drawers full of rejections. And they got the last laugh, because somebody finally landed on the book, published it, and it soared to the top of the list. It does happen. It doesn't happen often, but it happens with more regularity than people want to believe. So sometimes just staying dedicated to a concept and to a genre will pay off in the end. But oftentimes, I would say the better way to go is a traditional publishing house. And then if you want to publish yourself later, fine. But try and gain the recognition of being with a publishing house first if you can do it.
Yeah.
I was recently speaking at a conference up in Writers Conference in Alaska, and people were asking, this question seems to be asked a lot right now, especially at writers' conferences. And, basically I said, I don't really care who publishes your book or how your book gets published. I care about when. And so far, every self-published book that I've read wasn't ready to be published.
Right.
It just wasn't ready. I mean, maybe the kernel of the idea was there, or maybe the story, kind of was there, but they just hadn't gone through enough drafts or edits or whatever to really hone it and really make it shine. They just got tired of editing and just pressed the button and published it. And so, I think that's good advice. If we find ourselves, being rejected, evaluate and say maybe the story is needs some work yet, and there's probably a reason why. Maybe it hasn't gotten picked up.
The other thing is the ability to take good editing. I remember I had an editor once many years ago, and in some ways I didn't stay with the editor long. I should have. He was an excellent editor, maybe the best I've ever had, actually. And he gave me some line notes on a book, And it was, in fact, it was compelling evidence in the early going. And his edits were worth gold. I mean, they really were. He had an ability to cut to the core of the weaknesses in a story, point them out to you, and if you had the ability to take that kind of criticism constructively, okay, and not let it destroy you in terms of your ego, and then respond to it in a way that allowed you to make the corrections. I remember he sent me his line notes. I sent him my edits back, and we had a telephone conversation about 3 days later, and he said, it's remarkable, he said, and I took this as an immense compliment. He said, you have the ability to benefit from editing more so than anyone I've seen in recent years. And I said, well, thank you. I said, maybe it's because of your editing, you know. But this guy had an incredible knack for editing. But yeah. And there are some tremendous editors out there, and they're worth their weight in gold when you find them. Yeah.
Now, I do want to ask about your newest release, mm-hmm. and if you could just tell us maybe about, is it The Enemy Inside, is that most recent, or do you have something else coming out that I don't even know about yet?
I have Blood Flag, which is coming out in May. In fact, it's in the editor's hands right now. We're working on line edits. And but that will be the title, and at least that's what I'm informed so far. And it should be out in May. That's a tentative publishing date for hardcover. The last book that did come out, which came out last May, was The Enemy Inside, and it was a book about basically international banking. It was about offshore accounts, the scandal that involved the IRS trying to pursue people who were hiding, American taxpayers who were trying to hide offshore accounts, okay? And it got wrapped up in politics in Washington and all the typical scandals that you see surrounding that kind of thing. And it had some good foreign venues in terms of location in Switzerland. So it offered a lot of opportunities for me to develop things that I really had wanted to write about for some years now. And it was a good book. I'd been out of print for a few years because I'd taken some time off. I was traveling. I was in Latin America for a while, and I was in Thailand and living the better part of my year in Thailand for about 4 years and 4 or 5 years. And so my writing had slowed down considerably. But I'm back in the saddle now. I've got I had contracts for 4 books. I finished 2. I've got 2 more to go. And hopefully more contracts after that. But, yeah, I had wanted to take some time off and refresh the brain a little bit, and I did that. So, but this book was a long time in thought in terms of probably ever since the collapse in 2008, the financial collapse. I'd been thinking of doing something in the banking area, something in the tax area, something that had an international flair to it. And I sort of combined all of these things and put them in that one book. And before that, I'd done a trilogy, which involved the cartels in Mexico, the drug cartels in Mexico, and a dark character that I wanted to develop for a long time, who was a hired assassin for the cartels in Mexico, who ran under the name Liquida. And I did that. That was the trilogy, a 3-book. Series that I did before that, again a Modriani book, which had quite a bit of good foreign locations in it, including Thailand, scenes set in Thailand. So I wasn't completely away from writing during my period. My production slowed down considerably. Yeah.
I like what you just said. I want to just probe that for just a minute, and that is this dark character that you kind of wanted to write about. I think in all of our novels, we'll have, obviously, forces of antagonism, whether it's an antagonist or a storm or something that gets in the way of our main character protagonist reaching or overcoming his obstacle or reaching his goal. So those antagonists sometimes are very intriguing. I know there are some I've written about where I'm like, I really am interested in this character, and they're very dark sometimes. Mm-hmm. How do you write that character? Did you tap into sort of a dark place inside of yourself, or did you just give free rein to your imagination with this character in that situation?
Well, when you write about dark characters, you're dealing sort of in the in the dark frontier, okay, sort of a lawless frontier where there really are no, when you think about what we do for a living, okay, we're writing lies for a living, okay, and so how inventive can the human mind get, okay, that's number one. Number two, all the things that society and our own ethics prohibit us from engaging in, we can certainly engage in through the powers of the mind, okay? And when you then create an individual and you put him on paper, and that individual is pathologic, okay, it allows the mind to run wild, and there are no inhibitions any longer, you know. Now, when I say that, there certainly are some, because there are certain things a publisher is simply not going to publish, okay? But with the exclusion of those, you know, things, those areas where the publisher might refrain from wanting to publish in, we have a very wide latitude of things that you can write about, okay?
Yeah.
And this character was completely without morals, okay? The one I wrote about, I mean, he would kill at the drop of a hat. He enjoyed it. I mean, there was a real mental illness going on here with this character, okay? But he was also paid well for what he did, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was, in many respects, the parallel of a character that you would have seen in the 1930s running one of the powerful mobs, okay? These people thought nothing of killing people. They thought nothing of, I mean, if they were insulted, if their business was in any way invaded, life meant nothing to them, okay? It was cheap. And so these are, you know, we've merely refreshed this and brought it to a modern age. And there's a lot of things that people think about these dark individuals, okay, that are rumored, okay? When you create a character like Laquita, the one that I did in my trilogy, a couple of things hold true in popular fiction. One is, in the end, you want to see goodness prevail, okay? That's number one. So you have to figure out how you're going to dispose of him. And it's difficult. It's painful to dispose of a character like that because in many, many respects, he drove the stories, okay? Mm. And you almost hated to let him go, you know?
Yeah.
And you let him go in such a way that maybe he can come back in the end, you know? It's like getting rid of Moriarty, you know? And, you know, do you really want to kill him, you know? Maybe not, you know? Whenever the story started to run cold, there's a couple of lessons that are told out there by people who write popular fiction. One is, when a story starts to sag, kill somebody, you know. And Laquita was very handy in that respect. So whenever the story started to sag a little bit, you know, and you wanted a little more action, you found somebody for him to kill. And the other was to create enough characters to be killed. And oftentimes, in some of my more recent stories, I start running out of characters to kill. You know, you got to bring somebody into the picture who maybe wasn't there in the beginning so that you've got another victim to get rid of. Otherwise, the story is going to start to lag a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, these are devices that you use in popular fiction, but they have to be carefully used. You don't want to overuse them. You don't want to just have gratuitous violence on the page just for the sake of it. So it has to move the story forward. And it has to be tied in, hopefully with a good twist somewhere along the way. So, and the story I just wrote just had that. You know, I don't want to give too much away, but it's, you know, when you build certain characters up to break them down, okay?
Mm.
You build up the anticipation that a certain number of evil characters are almost beyond the pale. That is, they are so good at what they do that no one's ever going to be able to overtake them, okay? That no one's ever going to be able to go into hand-to-hand combat with one of these people and survive, okay? And so there is the potential for a wicked twist, okay, when you think about it. So, it's playing on those kinds of things, the expectation of readers that you can create, okay, just by, not so much by saying things as by showing them, okay? You show someone with tremendous skill at doing something that is dastardly, okay? And then all of a sudden confront the reader with the twist that he may have been evil, but there's always someone who's more evil. So it's like
good.
Being rich. There's always somebody who's richer. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, good. So, Steve, of course, we want readers to pick up your books.
Mm-hmm.
Which one would you suggest they might start with if they haven't read your work before? And then tell us the best place for them to connect with you online, web, Twitter, Facebook,
okay.
Wherever you're present.
Well, let's start with the books first.
Yeah.
The most recent books, I would probably start with Shadow of Power, okay, which is the first in the three-part trilogy. All right.
Oh, nice.
Those are the most recent books, okay? Shadow of Power, Guardian of Lies, and The Rule of Nine, okay? And then there's Traitor of Secrets, which is, again, one of the more recent books, and then The Enemy Inside, which was the last book. I would probably start with those and then go back and pick up the earlier books, which Simeon Chamber, Compelling Evidence, Prime Witness, all of those earlier trial books to come forward in the trial venue. They're almost like two different sets of books in many respects. The earlier books being in the courtroom, the later books being outside the courtroom, and then just see which ones they like most. And then, of course, we'll have the book will be out in May, which will be Blood Flag, and a tremendous amount of history in that book. So I would encourage them to read that as well. In terms of my website, it's stevemartini.com, okay, and that's our official website. And I'm available on Facebook at Steve Martini. That's the official site, again. And on Twitter at Stephen P. Martini on Twitter. So, you can obtain all the information on the entire list of books on our website at stevemartini.com. Yep.
Fantastic. Well, good. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for being here. And it was an honor to have you join us. And I was actually taking notes as you were talking.
Me too.
I always loved doing that.
Great.
I love the stuff about your process of research, also cutting close to the bone of reality, writing lies for a living. I think these are all very insightful and pithy, and I love it. So thanks, Steve, for being here. For info about my books, you can check, click to stephenjames.net.
And to find out more about me and my writing, susanmaywarren.com.
For info about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of story is all in the blend.
See you next time.